Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 260 of Registry Matters. How are you this evening?
I am doing marvelous here. I'm ready for a great program, so let's fire this thing up.
All right, so diving right in, let's cover this. No, so first of all, we had a whole bunch of new viewers because of I guess we could call it amplification, that Narsal sent out a post giving us some kudos for covering the Rhode Island case that we covered last week. So welcome to all of you new YouTube people. But I also want to make sure that everyone knows that this is actually a podcast. And so please find your favorite podcast app and search for Registry Matters, and you can download it. And then it's just on your beautiful phone, and while you're driving to work or you're doing house chores, you can put on your headphones, and you can listen to the program all just the same. That's my preferred way to catch these things. But I know that you're big on the YouTube thing, and which is great, because maybe one day we can actually turn on the button that says monetize. I know that would excite you.
Oh, it would, because it's going to be a $40,000 a month payout, just like these people who tell all these falsehoods about Social Security and various things, not just Social Security. Now it's the banking crisis. They're making gobs of money, scaring people about their money, and not a dime has ever been lost in an insured deposit account.
And you know, just to noodle around there, I was listening to a tech-heavy podcast, and they were talking about that. That maybe 72 hours into it, then the government said that they would cover everyone's deposits, no matter how big it is. So then all it really was a bank run?
That's all it was to begin with. It was a bank run.
Right.
That caused it. The bank was well capitalized. There was never any reason for people to be afraid other than the fact that there was a large ratio of uninsured deposits in that particular institution, Silicon Valley, because of the great wealth that created and supported that bank. 90% of the depositors were over the $250,000 FDIC limit.
Right.
And those sophisticated people started running the bank because they got word that the bank might be insolvent. Well, the bank wasn't insolvent. The bank was as solvent as it had ever been. They were sitting on United States treasuries, which are safe, which are always generally deemed as a place to put excess cash. And that's what they were doing. But the problem is with the rising interest rates, the treasuries had declined in market resale value, and they began to need that money because of the deposit run, which continue to accelerate when all the geniuses kept spreading the word about how dangerous the bank was. And no bank can withstand a run. Not a single bank in the land can withstand a run because you don't have all your money. The bank doesn't have all your deposits in cash. They just don't. They have at most 10%.
And an angle that I hadn't considered is that a company like, I'm only using this just so that it's like Kleenex, but ADP, the payroll processing place, you, the small business, would send your money to ADP, and then ADP would send all the payments out to the employees. But ADP might have had their money in the Silicon Valley Bank, and then they couldn't make payroll. And that obviously disrupts a bunch of people's lives that have nothing to do with Silicon Valley.
That is correct. And it was the prudent thing to do to cover the deposits, because every bank has uninsured depositors. And if you don't cover the deposits of uninsured people, those who have greater deposits than FDIC limits, then you would have a run across the spectrum of people saying, well, I've got to get underneath the deposit limit because this bank failed taught us a lesson that we can lose our money. And that would be an unsustainable position because most banks have greater than 10% of their deposits as uninsured. And at most, they're going to have 10% capital. That's considered well capitalized. And banks, you can't put all the money in cash. If you did that, you would not be able to pay employees for their salaries.
Right.
You would not be able to pay benefits. You wouldn't be able to pay federal deposit insurance. You wouldn't be able to pay rent. You wouldn't be able to pay for marketing. You wouldn't be able to pay for technology costs. On and on and on, you would not be able to pay for. So therefore, the bank has to deploy those assets in interest-earning opportunities.
Totally. All right. That was a big enough detour. Anyway, my whole point was make sure that you like and subscribe and press all the buttons and do all the whiz bang things that we need you to do so that we can have a happy, successful place that we live here on YouTube and podcast app and It's on Pandora and Spotify. You can find it anywhere. Just search for Registry Matters, and the big blue crisscross logo will show up, and click subscribe, and that will make me so happy. But please. So on YouTube, Larry, before we dive into what are we going to do, this is really important stuff. We need to cover some terms because there were some YouTube questions that people had asked for, and the big one was, would you please explain to the fine audience what is a PFR?
Well, a PFR would be a person who's forced to register. Most people are forced to register. I haven't heard of a lot of volunteers going in for that duty.
You need to come in the Discord server because I found one. But that's a conversation for another day. Okay, so a person forced to register. Very good. Now, the second question that someone then asked was, so what does FYP stand for? And I gave an answer. I asked ChatGPT to give me 5 examples, and so from here, and then you can chime in with whatever you want to say, Larry. But so we have frequent yoga practice, fierce yet playful, fearless young prisoners, freshly baked pastries, and friendly yellow parakeet. Now, if you have any that you would like to add to that, feel free, Larry.
I can't think of any, but I'm not sure which one of those it actually is. We'll have to find
out. Me neither. We will. Well, then, so without further ado, please give us the rundown of what we're going to do tonight.
Well, we're going to have you read something from Fort Leavenworth, and we'll chat about it briefly. Then we're going to be talking about a legislative proposal in Louisiana that deals with PFRs. And then we have a segment on plea bargaining, on the process of plea bargaining. And if time permits, we have a potential cert petition for U.S. Supreme Court, which I've already decided we're going to move that over to the next episode. And I think we have a video clip and some commentary about the arrest and conviction of Clayton County Sheriff Victor Hill.
Yes, we do. Well, very good. So I will be the reading from our friends at Fort Leavenworth. Let's begin where we covered a couple weeks ago. It would have been episode 258 regarding the increase in reported sexual assaults at U.S. military academies, only because I never want this stuff to go unchallenged. I don't have access to the article, and I'm reading as the person from Fort Leavenworth, if that wasn't clear to begin. I don't have access to the article, but I'm sure it's more of the normal number twisting from the same groups I've mentioned before. Let me address the outrage on Capitol Hill. The expanded assistance programs you mentioned from the article are in the form of thousands of dollars, to say nothing of lightened class loads while in school and choice assignments after. I'm just skimming this topic here, but yes, when increased enticements to the courts, reports will go up, and of course, they will be higher than civilian universities that do not have similar incentives. What these articles conveniently leave out is that the one in five number comes from surveys of females who say something happened to them at some point in the last year, usually using the dangerously ambiguous but serious-sounding term unwanted sexual contact, which is a journalism term, not a codified crime. Most of those incidents don't get reported, and the ones that do, only a small percentage, somewhere around 10%, are found with merit. The numbers read a lot different when you phrase it that way, and for the record, these are Department of Defense numbers citing. You're a legal guy, so you tell me, is there another crime that is measured in unfounded reports? For instance, does saying, I was robbed last week, but I never reported it, drive down the property values in a neighborhood? In what other instance is legislation based on unfounded claims? That's what makes this topic so unique. So feel free, Larry. We've talked about it. I don't think we've ever come up with one. Is there another type of crime that has only like eyewitness testimony, or they're generating statistical incidents based on, I guess it would just be hearsay?
I'm not aware. I mean, that's a great point in terms of the uniform crime statistics about unreported stuff being counted as criminal activity. And then he makes the point about unwanted advances. An unwanted advance is not necessarily a crime. It is not. I can go out on the street all day long and say, you're cute, would you like a date? That's an unwanted advance, but it's not a crime.
Would there be any action that could be pursued? If you kept pursuing, then they could do things like restraining orders or whatever. But otherwise, Can the police ever do anything to you? I guess they could talk to you, but what else could they do?
Well, they could do a stop and talk, but there's nothing unlawful about going out and telling every person you encounter that they're cute and you'd like to go on a date with them. Now, if you follow them in a way that causes them to have concerns about their safety, then you could be possibly charged with a crime of stalking. But just simply going out telling them, I have the right to tell you that you're cute all day long. And that's unwanted, but it's not unlawful.
Very good. All right, well then to continue, why is this an important distinction? Because while we will parse the discrepancy in the data, the rest of the country sees a headline and acts accordingly. For example, during, oh God, V-O-I-R-D-I-R-E, two words, V-O-I-R-D-I-R-E. What's this word? I tried to learn how to pronounce it and I've forgotten.
Voir dire.
And what is that?
It's a process before a tribunal convenes a trial. You're selecting the members of the tribunal. The civilian world would be a jury, but you're trying to find out if they can be fair and impartial. So you go through these questions, either the attorneys or the court itself, but usually they're done in advance. A lot of questionnaires are sent to potential jurors to try to find out if they can be fair and impartial.
All right, then. All right. For example, during a voir dire, a common question to the panel, quote-unquote jury, is, do you believe the military is facing an epidemic of sexual assault? And the common answer, of course, is yes. But when asked to expound upon this, the most frequent response is, well, that's what I have heard. We are basing policy and convicting people on, essentially, an urban myth. To close it out, the reality is college students are acting as college students always have, badly. But now, what once was called regret sex or the walk of shame can lead to a big payout and or other benefits. These anonymous surveys are being answered through a fog of alcohol-addled memories, and the numbers are being used to fuel an agenda that seems to have no sign of stopping. The time is coming when everyone will know a man who has had at least been accused of sexual assault sometime in their life. Maybe then, some semblance of sanity will return to the halls of those who produce legislation.
He did a great job, and thanks to the person who took this dictation by telephone.
Was it you?
It was not me, but I did a little bit of cleanup on it because I could see what he intended to say. But thanks to the person who took the dictation, we're glad to give him the outlet to say this.
Yeah, I don't think this, I don't want to take away from anybody that actually does end up having unwanted advances that turn into something that then turn into something that goes criminal. I don't want to take any away from that because I know what happens and it's disgusting. And if no means no, right?
I've heard that.
But I don't know how you're supposed to, do we set up some sort of meeting place in the middle and this is where you go? Oh, we should have singles bars. You go to the middle so that you are sure that the people there are trying to meet people there. Without, I don't know. This is so complicated.
That wouldn't fix the problem because they can still have buyer's remorse. They can have buyer's remorse and say that they were too drunk to give consent, on and on. I mean, he makes great points.
Agreed. All right. Well, we will move along then. Let's move over to Louisiana House Bill 135. This is being proposed. What does this legislation seek to do, sir?
Well, it would add a section in the statutes of Louisiana that would criminalize a PFR from working in polling locations anywhere in the state of Louisiana.
Why in the world would they do that? Like, what would be the rationale behind saying a PFR cannot work at a polling station?
I did try calling the sponsor, but he didn't pick up, so I don't know.
All right, well, there's been considerable chatter on the affiliates list, the NARSAL affiliates list today. And you told me that in pre-show, you were not convinced that the strategy being discussed is the best approach. Can you tell me and tell the audience with some of your brilliance what they should do instead?
Well, I freely admit that I don't have all the answers. My strategy may not work, and I admit that. But I just want everyone to understand that arguing recidivism is most unlikely to be successful, and that's where everybody wants to go.
What would you do instead?
Well, first, you must recognize that the Democratic Party cannot help you in Louisiana. People tend to, because the Democrats are, quote, soft on crime, they tend to want to run to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party cannot help you in Louisiana. This means that you shouldn't take any trips to see Democrats because they really can't help. The battle will be won or lost with the Republicans.
I'm imagining that the split there is like 80-20 or something ridiculous like that for Team Red.
Very close, yes.
Doesn't Louisiana, though, have a Democratic governor?
They do indeed.
Okay, and didn't one of our patrons recently remind us of that and that state of Louisiana was a Democratic state?
Yes, that's why I put this in here. This is directed towards the listener who assured us that it's a Democratic state. The current governor is a Democrat. Unfortunately, that does not make Louisiana a Democratic state. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. He's the only Democratic office holder on the whole list of statewide offices, and including lieutenant governors, Republican. Governor John Bel Edwards is an anomaly that occurred due to the flawed candidate on the Republican side in 2015. His opponent was former U.S. Senator David Vitter. Remember the one that added additional restrictions to keep food stamps from people that had PFR convictions? Do you remember him?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, and Republicans now have supermajorities in both houses of the state assembly. A long-term Democrat just switched parties, and that one switch gave them supermajorities.
And remind us what supermajority means?
That means that the Republicans have enough votes to override Governor Edwards. And it doesn't matter what Edwards thinks, because with a supermajority, anything that the Republicans want to do, there is no check and balance in the system. And they achieved this supermajority status with a longtime Democrat that had been in office since the 70s switched to his party affiliation.
And so to move forward, what would you suggest as the best strategy to try and correct these kinds of things?
Well, in my opinion, you must focus on 2 points if you're to have any hope. Point one, this has to be hammered. This is a solution that's in search of a problem. All elections are held in public facilities where there are ample supervision. And at most, I would guess that there's video surveillance, meaning that there's no hanky-panky going on. So you have to tell the small government people, and this is who we're talking to, folks. We're talking to those who claim to be small government. You have to tell them that you have, throughout your career, stood strong against expansion of government intervention when there's not a problem. This is a solution that's searching desperately for a problem. That's point one. And point two, this is a big one, and I don't know which order. I haven't decided I would present this. This proposal will drive up the cost of elections and make it more difficult for election officials to hire enough poll workers. And again, you're dealing with a conservative, supposedly fiscally responsible group that guard every penny with their life. And you appeal to their no-nonsense approach that the government doesn't need to drive up the cost, because if you reduce the pool of election workers, I mean, you start with this felony, what comes next? But you start with making it more difficult. And you tell them, look, it's hard enough for the election poll positions to be filled already. And I guarantee you, because I'm in touch with that in my state, we're constantly trying to find old geezers to get into work, because that's the only ones we can find to work in polls, poll locations.
Right.
And they don't pay enough money. And then you lop off a segment of people that are eligible to work otherwise in the polls. You've just driven up the cost and made the work, the positions more difficult to fill. You tell them that, and you tell them how important it is that we don't work our older, elderly people to death, and that we don't make it more difficult for the people who are trying to run elections to have the workers they need. Throw your recidivism straight into the trash can, because you can't win with that.
And I'm trying. I had some things I was going to say, but they're all kind of snarky. It was suggested that the sponsor be contacted. Do you think that would be a good idea?
It would be, but only if you had a personal relationship with a sponsor. The sponsor is Mike Johnson, and he's in leadership. I forget what his position is. I looked it up, but he's in the House leadership. And you're not likely to have access to him unless he knows you. And he's not going to, because a stranger, if he did pick up the phone, a stranger calls him and says, this is a bad piece of legislation. He's not likely to dump it. So, oh, well, I didn't think of that. I mean, it just doesn't work that way.
So there you go again. You're bringing your name back as Mr. Doom and Gloom. So who should they contact instead? They can't contact any Democrats because what good would that do? If all of them voted against it, the supermajority would override them.
Well, you want to work with the House committee or committees, and I don't know how many committees they'll have or will assign this bill to, but that's who you want to start with. In addition, you want to find parish election officials, as they refer to their counties as parishes, and see if they will join in. And they're not likely to say that they favor PFRs to be working in the polls, but they will say, likely say, that they have difficulty already recruiting poll workers, and this reduction in eligible workforce will only compound that problem. And that would be my approach of what I would do.
All right. And then a comment was posted that reads, when you strip someone of their value as a human being and make it where they cannot participate in society in any meaningful way, you strip away any incentive to better themselves as human being. Is that a good approach?
It's a fabulous statement. Unfortunately, it's really far too broad. It really is. It's far down the list of what I would do. If you get a dialogue started and you're gaining traction, I would bring that in, but I wouldn't start with that. I mean, it sounds kind of vague. You go in and say, this is a bad bill. Why is it bad? Well, if you strip people of their dignity, do you see how, what I'm saying? That really doesn't tie together in a meaningful way to me.
I gotcha. And let's say that the bill passes and is sent to the governor. Can or would he veto? I think we kind of already covered that, but.
Yeah. So, yes, he could. He could definitely veto it. He does possess the power to veto. But a veto is not likely. It's extremely unlikely. Remember that the Republicans have a supermajority in both houses. They would move to override immediately. In addition, any Democrat who dared to vote with Governor Edwards, meaning to sustain the veto, would be setting themselves up to be taken out of the next election cycle. And that's just not a good position to put yourself in. And then you've got another problem, is that Governor Edwards is in his final months in office. Louisiana has a strange election cycle where he got elected in 15, he got reelected 4 years later, and I think he's up term limited. So you would be asking people to stand with a lame duck governor, to vote with him in a futile endeavor because the Republicans have the supermajority status. So you'd have to peel off at least one Republican so that you would not. And so you'd have to reach for the stars and find a Republican that would not vote to override. And they would be stripped of their committee chairmanships or any decent committee assignments if they did that by the Republican leadership. And you would be asking people to vote to sustain in a futile endeavor so that they could be taken out of office in the next election cycle. That is just not a reasonable expectation to impose on them. They will vote to override John Bel Edwards if this gets to his desk.
I'm not going to articulate this very, very delicately or very well, but it seems that in the last presidential election, we learned that at least the ballot counting places are very well camera-ified. And I would imagine then that there is some level of camera-ness at the polling stations where, I mean, what is someone going to do in a public building to where they could, why would this even be introduced, Larry? I don't even understand where this would come from to be introduced. Oh my God, we have to fix this loophole of PFRs working at polling stations. I can't even imagine that this is a thing.
Well, again, I'm not in Louisiana, so I don't know that I could give you anything other than a speculation. But if this sponsor has risen to House leadership, he's likely in a safe seat. So he's not worried about his reelection. He's likely in a safe seat. You generally, not always, but generally the people who have strong backing in their districts are likely to be in leadership because there's so many enemies you can make in leadership that can cost you that seat. And you don't want to expose a person, particularly when a thin majority. Now, they don't have a thin majority, they have a supermajority, but particularly in a thin majority situation. So he's likely in a safe seat. So probably, I would guess, that some constituent went and voted and approached him and said, "You're not going to believe this, but I went to vote and I took my 9-year-old to the polls, and you wouldn't believe who was sitting there to check me in at the polling location. It was a person on the PFR registry. And something ought to be done about that." And he checked his records and he says, "Oh, well, I see that you've given me donations and you've been hosting house parties and stuff for me for 22 years I've been in office." And I don't think he's been in office that long. But yes, something ought to be done about that. I'll carry a bill. And if the bill doesn't pass, he's not going to lose his office. How hard he's going to work the bill, I don't know. But if this bill gains any traction, folks, you can't stop it. If it gets to the governor will sign it. So you guys that are all dead set against voting for any Democrats, you need to go contact the Republicans and you need to try to win over one or two of them if you want to try to stop this in key committees. Otherwise, it's going to the governor and it's going to become law.
I need to post that doom and gloom picture of you again. Anything else here before we move along?
I think I've done it, unless there's 1,000 questions in live chat.
The only thing that I think, well, first of all, Brian Louisiana says he hasn't been here in months, and the one night he joins, we're talking about Louisiana, which is super duper coincidental. But I did see, is this a NIMBY law? Is it not in my backyard? Which is kind of what you just described of somebody going to a polling station. I know you're speculating, but that does sound like a legit reason that this would have come about.
Well, I say that because I haven't seen this making its way around the nation. Therefore, it may be unique to Louisiana. But when we start seeing this in other states, then we'll know that there's an advocacy cause pushing it. But right now, I'm not familiar with this bill. Maybe some of our chat people, particularly there's one in Maryland, if this has made its way through Maryland, but I think it's unique.
But to go back to your talking about the poll workers, don't we struggle to find anybody to go in there and be a poll worker? And generally, they're 150 years old.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned earlier. It's very difficult to fill those positions. It's very difficult. And that's your appeal to the conservative, responsible, fiscally frugal people is, man, we don't want to make it more difficult for our election administrators to find and fill these job positions.
Yeah,
we don't need,
because then they would have to drive up and make them pay more to incentivize more people to show up.
That is correct. And they claim that they're the guardians of the purse. And you remind them of that. You say, "Look, you know, I have been a great admirer of how fiscally responsible you've been throughout your career. Now we need to hold fast and tight to that fiscal responsibility. This is not something responsible. What comes next after this? This is a slippery slope. You turn their arguments on them. Next, it's going to be people who have dealt drugs. And who's going to come next? And first thing you know, we won't have any former felons, anybody with a criminal record, allowed to work in polling locations. This is silly, absurd, and let's kill it."
Very good.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Do you want to talk about plea bargains now?
I do. We're getting a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but we're getting a steady stream of letters at NARSL and occasionally an email to FYP about plea bargains, and people don't understand why I don't understand that we could crash the system if we would just all unite together. So I'm going to have a discussion tonight about plea bargains because I'm going to let the people educate me about what I don't understand. So fire it up.
Well, clear you don't, because pretty much the day that I stepped into like the county jail, someone was saying, "Well, everyone should take it to trial. That way, you know, the system would collapse and they couldn't have all the people locked up." And I thought that didn't sound like the worst of ideas, Lay. But so here the question is, My public defender pressured me to plead guilty, and now I regret it. This is my first felony, and the justice system seems totally rigged and so unfair. He told me that things would go much better for me if I accepted the plea bargain, and that it was a good deal. It sent me to prison for 9 years. So much for a good deal. Can you admit that a plea bargain process is broken?
Yes, I can admit that. Unfortunately, there's not an alternative on the horizon.
He went on to say, the police broke every rule in the book. They lied to me and said that they would get me help if I cooperated and made numerous threats of bad things if I didn't. At one point, I asked if I should have a lawyer. They said no. I cooperated with them, and now I'm serving a lengthy prison sentence. Why is it that the police are allowed to lie and nothing about this is ever mentioned in court while they were allowed to make me look like a monster when I was sentenced? This is not fair! Is it fair?
Well, I don't know all the specifics of this case, so I can't really say if it's fair. It could be a very good outcome, depending on all the facts of the case. I will point out that he did not say if this was his first felony.
Why does that even matter?
Well, if he had a previous felony, he could have been subjected to an enhancement, which in some cases can be life in prison. I'd say 9 years is preferable to life, wouldn't you?
I would argue that life is worse than nine. So you have a way of justifying the impossible. What am I missing?
Well, first we would need to know what the potential incarceration was he was facing if he had taken the case to trial, meaning convicted on all counts, and they had sentenced consecutively. What would he have been looking at? Second, we would need to know if he confessed, which would have given the prosecution a very strong hand to play. And third, we would need to know if there was a victim, and would that person have made a credible witness had there been a trial? All those things would help me to formulate an opinion if I knew those things.
And while we're sitting right there, roll back, I don't know, 20 episodes and go find Don't Talk to the Police and make sure that that rule is adhered to. All right, well, you have justified that. How can you justify what he said next? He stated that the police lied and promised him that if he cooperated. And what spin do you have for this one?
Well, the police are generally allowed to lie without any consequences, so that's my spin. The reason is it's so vitally important that that's the reason why it's vitally important that suspects not speak with the police without the advice of a criminal defense attorney. The theory is that all the benefits of the reduced sentence would remedy any of the police misconduct, including lying. That's the theory about plea bargaining, is that you, as a defense attorney, you make your argument to the prosecutor, well, the cops did this wrong. Now, lying is not wrong in terms of legally, but anything that they did in the way of breaking the rules of evidence, if they searched without a warrant, if they didn't properly Mirandize, you make that argument to the prosecutor. You know, I've got some good motions I can do here. But in terms of lying, you've got not a leg to stand on.
Well, let me get this straight, though. The police can use deceptive interrogation tactics, and that's not a problem?
You're correct. In Frazier versus Cupp, United States Supreme Court said in 1969, they affirmed the legality of the deceptive interrogation tactics. And that case was acting on a tip. The police picked up and interrogated Martin Frazier, a 20-year-old U.S. Marine, about his possible involvement in the murder of Russell Anton Marlowe. They lied to him. They told him that they had the evidence they needed. They made the deceptive statements, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, doesn't matter. He confessed.
I'm not going to let you off that easily, because we have an article here, plea bargain is broken, we can fix it, in the Las Vegas Sun newspaper. And it says, when Carolyn Jean Hamm was found hanged in her basement in Arlington, Virginia, police suspected a strange young man seen in the area named David Vasquez. Prosecutors, aware of significant weaknesses in the case, offered him a deal. The deal was, if I entered an Alford plea, which allowed him to claim innocence in open court while pleading guilty to rape and murder, prosecutors would take the death penalty off the table. As it turned out, he did not do it. Can you finally admit this was not a good deal?
No, I cannot admit that. He might only be alive today. He might not be alive today, but for the plea deal. So I'd say that it might have been a great deal, but remember that that took the death penalty off the table.
Yeah, but he might not have been guilty. The article also states prosecutor. What? Go ahead.
Well, but he also might be dead.
That's true, but innocent until proven guilty, though, right?
Well, but if they had convicted him with the weak evidence they had, now that's a big if, but he might be dead. So I would say that the plea bargain may have saved his life.
Maybe. All right. Well, the article states prosecutors eventually learned the plea offer they had made to guarantee a conviction in a weak case had actually coerced an innocent man to falsely plead guilty. Moreover, that coercive bargain had allowed a serial killer to kill again. In total, 13 women were attacked by the man who became known as the Southside Strangler. And so back to Mr. David Vasquez, who was innocent. What do you have to say to that?
I'd say it's clearly a tragedy in this case.
The Plea Bargain Task Force, a group convened by the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section, has studied the problem for 4 years. The task force is a bipartisan group of prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, academics, and members of various think tanks and advocacy organizations. In a new report, the task force proposes several major steps that we think can be taken by legislatures, lawyers, judges, and court administrators to create a more fair and more transparent plea bargaining system. Has it always been this way?
No, it hasn't. In the 1960s, going back when I was probably approaching my retirement age, the trial rate was four times higher than it is today. More cases were proceeding to trial where a citizen jury could test the credibility of witnesses and the strength of the prosecutor's case, and where misconduct by police and other government actors could be discovered. But a higher trial rate also meant that appellate courts regularly had timely and important issues to decide that would create precedential guidance for lawyers. This is no longer the situation today because the rules have changed. Like when you don't plead out of the federal system, you get enhancements if you're found guilty just for mere avoiding responsibility. So it's like all the rules have changed. And so, and beyond that, the strength of the cases today with the evidence we have, the forensics were in infancy in the 1960s. Would you agree with that?
Certainly.
Compared to today's forensics. The cases are a lot stronger today that they have against you. They have evidence we couldn't have even dreamt about in the 1960s available to them today that can be powerful in the circumstantial nature of what they have against you, although they may not have an eyewitness, but they can have powerful circumstantial evidence. And it might be totally innocent circumstantial evidence. What happens if you pick up a hitchhiker who later, the next person who picks them up kills them and they find the DNA in your car of the dead person? That's powerful.
Yep.
So you have a tough time explaining to a jury how a person found dead later and their DNA is in your car.
The article noted that the current trial rate in most of the country for felonies, however, hovers around 2%. That's two, not one and not three, but two. In today's courtrooms, defendants rarely opt for a trial. Instead, they plead guilty in exchange for some benefit. These deals are often so lopsided that even innocent people like Vasquez will plead guilty. Do you agree to that?
I do agree to that. Yes, I agree with that completely. We need more trials to promote accountability. But I don't see it happen. I don't see it happening. There would be too many things we would have to change. We also need fairer and more transparent plea agreements for those who decide to plead guilty. A lot of people don't even understand, despite the fact that they state in open court where they get that litany of questions, they didn't understand completely what they were doing. Mm-hmm. It was a big fog to them.
And you're only brought those, at least in my case, I was only made aware of all the things that I was agreeing to the day of court and signing over all of those. And you're in a crowded ass, well, the courtroom was certainly noisy and you're attached to like the holding cell thing. So that's a whole big pocket of noise. And then you're trying to talk through the glass to your attorney. Like you can't hear a effing thing. She's trying to explain to me, do you agree to this? And I'm like, ha, because all I hear is, like, what? And then we're getting yelled at from the courtroom that we're being too loud.
So, well, and now, in theory, you could have, when the judge said, Do you understand all this? You could have said, no, Your Honor, I couldn't understand anything that was being said by my attorney. That was all garbled. I was talking through a speaker, and I was being told to hush. And no, Your Honor, I don't understand a thing. You could have done that.
I'm not even sure what would that have done for me other than I kick the can down the road for later. I mean, I just don't even understand what that would have done for me.
What it would have done?
This was baked into the cake.
What it would have done is the judge would have stopped that proceeding, and the judge would have said, counsel, have you not spent any time with your client to explain this? And the judge, the attorney would say, no, Your Honor, I've got a very heavy caseload, and today's the first day I've gone over the plea. And the judge would say, well, we're going to reschedule this. And yeah, if it's still your client's intention to plead guilty, you will go over this very thoroughly, and you'll come back into court, and we're going to set this out on next calendar. We'll see you in 6 weeks. That's what the judge would have done.
Right. So again, it wouldn't really have changed anything other than my understanding of all the pieces of the puzzle. But all of that to say, I bet you almost everybody that does this is in the same boat as me.
You are correct, and therefore we need to fix that. We need to make sure. Yep. A judge could ask the person, after, rather than asking the question, the judge could say, we've got a plea here. Mr. Defendant, can you tell us what it is you're doing here? Can you explain to the court what we're doing here today? Your Honor, I came to plead guilty. Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty? Did you commit the crime? So let me read the indictment to you, or what there been. It may not be the indictment, it may be the charges that you've agreed to plead to. Let me read the charges. Are you pleading to these because you actually did commit these offenses? Yes. Okay, so just to be clear, no one has made any promises or threatened you in any way. This is your admissions that on these dates, and you would read from the document, you did commit this behavior. Yes. Okay, now you're giving up a lot of your rights. Do you understand what rights you're giving up? Yeah, yes. Well, okay, recite a few of those two. Tell me what rights you're giving up. It wouldn't take...
Everyone
it would extend,
say I'm giving up my rights to own a gun.
And, well, primarily in the plea process, you're giving up your right to confront and cross-examine and to point out all the things that the writer of this question mentioned about police misbehavior. You're not able to bring that in at that point because it's no longer relevant. You're pleading guilty, so what the police did is no longer relevant. But you would want the defendant to be able to explain to you a few things that they're surrendering in the way of their rights. And the judge would say, your list is not all-inclusive, but you have identified that you understand that this is going to put an end to this case. You will also be forfeiting a whole litany of rights that I'm going to go through with you. And if it's still your desire to plead guilty after I've gone through all this, then we'll continue this process. You're going to lengthen the process by a number of minutes each time. But also you're going to have people not being able to come back and say they don't understand what they're doing.
True.
Because we want you to understand what you're doing. At least I do. When you're surrendering all these rights, I want you to understand what you're doing. This is a lifetime decision you're making that cannot be reversed.
To read the conclusion, it says, we recommend that prosecutors never threaten to increase the charges or sentence for a defendant like Vasquez to force the case to resolution without a trial, nor should they threaten family members to induce a plea. Why would that one even be brought up, Larry?
Well, family members can be legitimately brought into it. You remember, like with Bernie Madoff. It's quite possible that his spouse knew what he was doing and may have even been an accomplice in it. The government may have had evidence. And it's quite fair to say, Bernie, hey, you know, this is the evidence we have on your wife. Now, we don't want to charge her, but we may have to.
But it says, nor should they threaten family members to induce a plea. It's just, okay. We also conclude that guilty pleas should not result from using impermissibly coercive incentives. We also recommend adopting more transparent plea procedures and collecting more data, including a more detailed record of each case that charts the plea offers and reasons for those offers. Do you agree?
I mostly agree. I don't think taking family members out of the equation is completely... I don't completely agree with that, because sometimes family members are fully involved or tangentially involved. And therefore, that is a legitimate offer to make to an accused. Do you want this person to go down with you? If you don't, we've got a deal for you.
A person in chat says, what I hate about plea bargains is you waive your right to appeal. There should be a way to appeal if you have new evidence in your favor, etc. I find it hard to swallow. You could probably find a reason to appeal if you were guilty in a trial, but not if you pled out.
So the question of that is what?
Well, not, I guess it wasn't a question, but he says what he hates. So what would be your response then if you, would there be a way to plea out, but then because there's overwhelming of evidence, but you still know that you're innocent, and then that you find some evidence down the line that would make it useful for you to bring it back into court to try and reverse it? Just because you took a plea, shouldn't the end result be the same in taking a plea versus taking it to trial?
It would depend on when the evidence was found and was it available at the time you did the plea. If you find totally new evidence that was not available, there's a good possibility you can get back into court if that evidence is strong enough that it would exonerate you. But it has to be pretty powerful evidence. It can't be speculative. People come in and say, well, if my attorney had done this, the court looks at that and says, wouldn't have changed the outcome if they had done that. But if there is conclusive evidence of innocence, you can generally find a way, not always, but generally you can find a way to get back into court to air that new evidence. But remember, you have said you did this thing. So it takes overwhelming evidence of your innocence, not just a theory of what could have happened. You have to have overwhelming evidence that what you are convicted of didn't happen. You didn't do it.
I knew some people that took plea deals that were like 10 years and they were potentially going to get sentenced to 40. And you will cave even if you're minorly guilty and you'll take the plea deal, just like this dude being accused of doing the killing and the raping, and he was like completely innocent, but because you won't get the death penalty or taking away life, like, okay, I guess I don't have to die and maybe I get another day in court perhaps, but I guess if he took a plea deal, does he ever get out if he took a plea?
It depends. What guys always want a straight answer. It depends. You can take a plea, and if you have proof of your innocence, you might get out. If you take a plea and you just don't like the taste of it after you got it, no, you're not going to get out under those circumstances.
Now, but once they went out and found the dude that did the actual 13 murders or whatever, did he get out after that?
I believe he got out. I believe he was exonerated. So, I mean, but if he had been executed, he would not be getting out.
But he would have gotten out, Larry. They wouldn't hold him in there.
Well, you have a point there, right? They would release his remains.
Sorry, that was a dark turn that we just took right there. All right. It's just a dirty system. That's all I got to say. I'm not saying that we can figure out a better way. Some of these recommendations do seem that it would make it more gooder. The prosecutor never threatened to increase the charges or sentence for a defendant like Vasquez to force the case to resolution without trial. So, like you said, the federal system, if you don't plead out, there are enhancements. Man, that's definitely a value add, I guess, if you take the plea deal that they, you know, here's your 5 years instead of 30 or 40.
That is correct. And then there's a political component as well. Remember, we had a presidential candidate in 2016 whose name is escaping me. But he promised to be the law and order president candidate, and he ordered his attorney general to seek maximum charges and maximum penalties. Do you remember that?
I do recall that. And the previous one was kind of hitting people with kid gloves for certain kinds of charges.
That is correct. So there's a political component of this as well. We have to be careful who we're voting for. And if they tell you they're going to seek maximum penalties and they're going to be the law and order person, please take them at their word.
Well, very good. Let's move along because we are starting to run out of time. And you wanted to mention the conviction of Clayton County Sheriff Victor Hill. Mr. Hill was convicted for violating the civil rights of people in his custody by unnecessarily strapping them into restraining chairs. He was sentenced Tuesday to serve a year and a half in prison, and a jury in October convicted him on 6 of 7 federal charges. Prosecutors had asked for a sentence of 3 years and 10 months in prison, while defense attorneys asked for a sentence of probation, home confinement, and a fine. Do you think that that's a just outcome?
Yeah, I think we need to play the video to set it up a little bit better.
Okay. We will go play this video then. Let's see. I'll turn that off. I'll try and do that thing. What just happened? I didn't mean that to happen. And then, so here's the clip, hopefully.
During the sentencing, four character witnesses spoke on Hill's behalf, including Interim Sheriff LaVon Allen. Each one of them talked about Hill's positive work out in the community. But prosecutors argued Hill's conduct inside the jail was an affront to our criminal justice system and that he tortured people by ordering them held in restraint chairs. Judge Ross told everyone in the courtroom that she truly struggled with this case and reminded the public that she was not here to punish Victor Hill for everything he's ever done or ever been accused of. Though before announcing Hill's sentence, she had some choice words for the former sheriff. As much as you love the law, your love of power overcame that, Ross told Hill. More than once, Judge Ross brought up Hill's arrogance and said she prays he will sit down for a moment and think about everything. In a video statement, Assistant Special Agent in Charge Chris McCray with the FBI Atlanta says everyone pays a price when law enforcement officials abuse their power.
The sentencing today should send a strong message to any law enforcement officer who wants to follow their own version of the law. As I said back at the indictment of the ex-sheriff Victor Hill, badges and guns don't come with the authority to ignore the Constitution. They come with the responsibility to protect it.
Just before learning his sentence, Sheriff Hill told Judge Ross his intent was never to hurt anybody. Hill's defense attorney, Drew Findling, says they will appeal and called the Justice Department's prosecution of the former sheriff selective.
It's the fact that he's been singled out.
I'll stop it there, though.
That's actually a great segment that you played. I was having trouble trying to figure out what part, but that's actually a great segment to play. And I like that comment about he was singled out. He was singled out. No, he wasn't singled out. He broke the law.
And not just law, Larry. He broke the civil rights, which are more than laws.
So you had a question. Is this a just outcome before I've diverted to that?
Yes,
it is. Mr. Hill will derive no additional benefit from a longer period of incarceration than what was imposed on him. So, yes, I think it is.
You don't even necessarily think that he was violating civil liberties, that he shouldn't have some sort of equivalent kind of civil liberty reduction applied to him?
Well, I think 18 months in a federal prison as a form of law enforcement, followed by 6 years of supervised release, that is a significant diminishment of his liberty. And yes, I think that is an adequate sentence for Mr. Hill.
In addition to the prison term, U.S. District Judge Eleanor Ross ordered Hill to serve 6 years under supervision once he is released. During that period, he must perform 100 hours of community service and cannot work in law enforcement or serve as a consultant to a law enforcement agency. So do you think that all works out okay?
I do. I think that this is, again, a former law enforcement officer is going to have a really tough time in prison. And, you know, what would you think an alternative would be for him? What would you think?
Wouldn't they put him somewhere special? Like, not in just general population? I don't think they do that. Because he could run into people that he locked up.
Well, he likely will run into people he locked up, or there will be people who will get the word out wherever he's placed in the BOP system.
Yep.
No matter where they put him around the country, Victor Hill is going to be marked, and he will not have an easy go of it no matter where he is.
Someone says in chat that they will put him in a soft compound. So you just say that he should be in general population? They should treat him like a normal inmate kind of person?
They won't be able to do that because he will need some level of protection. So he'll likely not be running around general population because his life will be in constant danger. He will likely be in some level of protection. And that means that his time will be far more difficult to serve than somebody who can run around in general population, work in a camp, and have a good job as far as good jobs go in the federal prison system. Victor Hill will not enjoy all those perks, I don't think.
Gotcha. So no club fed for this guy?
Well, they may assign him to a camp, but I don't think he's going to be able to be free to roam the camp because the word's going to get out. And someone is going to want to extract revenge on him. Doesn't take a whole lot of money to get someone to want to go after an ex-cop. And I just
just a handful of soups.
I don't think it's going to be an easy time for Victor Hill. And I just think that, I mean, we're minimizing a prison sentence followed by the supervision. So magically, we're doing a flip-flop here. We're saying that all of a sudden we're becoming the lock him up, throw away the key guy. This is boggling to me. If we want to apply any rational basis to this, this guy didn't kill anybody. The restraint chair doesn't kill you. He's not accused of a murder. He's accused of putting someone in a restraint chair that didn't belong there. Or more than one person in a restraint chair. I think there were six that he was indicted for, convicted of.
I don't disagree. I just, by comparison, by the amount of time that some people serve for certain kinds of crimes, the time that, generally speaking, U.S. citizens spend in prison is exorbitant. And then for this guy to get, quote unquote, 18 months seems a little bit on the short side compared to what we give other people for having some illegal substances.
Yeah, I tend to agree that our sentences are too long. We've covered that. And some people are mad because he's got voluntary surrender. But that's kind of normal in the federal system. A person who has long ties to a community and they've taken their passport away, and often they're under electronic monitoring until they surrender. There's nothing wrong with that either. I mean, it's very common in the federal system for a self-surrender to be afforded to the defendant.
Gotcha. Is there anything else that you want to, any of these articles that you want to cover? Because we have just a handful of minutes to go before we need to close it out.
So, well, I just feel like Victor Hill before we get to anything else. Victor Hill ought not have been doing what he was doing. He's been held accountable, and that's all we ask for people to be held accountable. I'm not on this big kick to lock people up for long periods of time. Accountability is not necessarily one and the same with a long prison sentence. He was disgraced. His law enforcement certification has been revoked. He was removed from office. He may have lost part of all of his pension. He's going to prison. He's coming out as a convicted felon with 6 years of supervision in the federal system, which is going to be very tight supervision. It's not as if he got a slap on the wrist. He has been properly admonished, and I don't think any additional benefit can accrue from a longer prison sentence or doing anything else to Victor Hill.
Because I guess if you make it a comparison to PFRs, his whole thing where he can't do any sort of consulting work for law enforcement, and as you said, convicted felon, those are all essentially life sentences. Of preventing him from working in an area that he would assume, presumably have a lot of experience in.
Absolutely. And I'm hoping that Mr. Hill is able to turn his life around, like I hope everybody, when he comes out of prison. Now, there's a chance that he may not actually serve all the time. He, of course, Drew Findling said he's going to appeal. And if the appeal is successful, he may not serve all the time. But we'll see. But we can do the Kansas public defender shortage. That shouldn't take long.
All right, let me find that one. That's the second one on that list. Let me put it up on the screen for our people. This one reads, Kansas public defender shortage reaches crisis point. A top public defender in Kansas says the state is at a crisis point on the 60th anniversary of a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, case that guarantees legal representation for those who can't afford to hire an attorney. Come on, you lefty mumbo-jumbo pointy-headed person. Why did you put this in here?
Well, you'd think after all the years of Gideon versus Wainwright, 60 years now, just this past week, that we would have recognized we need to provide adequate indigent defense. But we're not doing it. We haven't done it. My state hasn't done a good job of it. There's only one state in the country, you know which state that is, that's done a fantastic, fabulous job of defending the indigent, and that's up on the eastern seaboard, about mid-Atlantic region.
And I was going to say, is that Maryland and the Pures Wind Driven Snow?
That would be correct.
But, I guess that one, actually.
But this is a tragedy. What I would advise, not that anybody's listening, but every Kansas public defender, when they come in and when the judge says, state your appearances, or are we ready to go? If it's a trial setting, you specify, absolutely, Your Honor, I am not ready to go. And here's what you say. Listen carefully. due to the crushing caseload that I have, I will not be able to provide the accused constitutionally adequate defense. So in answer to your question, Your Honor, no, the defense is not ready. I promise you that will kill that case. I mean, it won't kill it indefinitely, but it will get it set off, because when you pronounce not ready, your client will be taken back in handcuffs and they will cuss you for everything that they can think if they're in custody. But that's what you need to do, is you need to say, I cannot provide my client constitutionally adequate defense, Your Honor. And if enough public defenders are doing that, we're in a situation right now where we don't have enough attorneys. So nobody would be fired like they would have been 5 years ago. They might fire one, but I doubt they'll even fire one. All of a sudden, the lawmakers in Kansas will discover that they have to provide indigent defense, because the system will really back up and the judges are going to start saying, hey, my docket is growing. The prosecution is going to say, we can't convict anybody. The jail administrators are going to say, our pretrial detention is going through the roof. And the legislature will act. This is what you need to do. It's not that hard. Just do it.
Is that significantly different than what we talked about of gumming up the system by no one taking plea deals?
It's similar but different, because you have an obligation to provide your client constitutionally effective representation. When the judge is asking you, are you ready? That's the same question that the judge is asking you about the plea. And rather than saying, yes, Your Honor, defense is ready, you say, no, Your Honor, defense is not ready. Now, if you are ready, then you wouldn't do that. You're not trying to not trying to obstruct the system. If you have a trial that you're properly prepared, you don't do that. But if you're not prepared, you announce on the record that you're not prepared.
And remind me, Larry, a public defender, like, what is their caseload compared to a private attorney?
Well, it depends on what level of charges you're talking about. If you're talking about misdemeanors, it's a much higher threshold. I'd have to look at the charts of the what's recommended, but typically they're carrying double and sometimes triple the caseload of serious felonies. And if you're in like the capital crimes division, you may only have a small handful of cases, because capital crimes are very intensive in terms of preparation. Someone's going to go to the gas house, you know, to the electric chair. So you can't handle 40 or 50 active death penalty cases. You might have
that
a dozen.
Legit.
But if you have a felony caseload of drug cases, that's one level of preparation. If you have a felony caseload that are more complicated with forensic stuff, with PFR type stuff, that's another. It depends on the division within the office that they're working in and what type of caseload they're handling. If they're in a really small office where they handle everything, then you have a whole unique set of circumstances, because the public defender may be handling the whole gamut. But like in a larger office, like in Albuquerque, they're handling a similar type caseload. So it's going to depend on the type of case they're handling.
And my follow-up question to that would be, what kind of time does a public defender get to spend with their client versus a paid attorney?
Well, it varies, of course. But a public defender is mostly going to be spending, as a general rule, less time because of the heavier caseload. And they're trying to prepare for court, spreading themselves over a number of appearances greater than your privately retained attorney is. If you're paying the private attorney $25,000, he or she can afford to give you more time. In a death penalty case, and we don't have death penalty, but in a life in prison, murder case, life in prison without parole here, a contract public defender only gets paid like $6,000 or $7,000. I forget what the amount is, but it's a very low amount of money. And then they have to ask for complex litigation pay if it's a particularly complicated case. That's not much money in today's world. What is that, 20 hours of work at $300 an hour?
Sounds like it, yeah. All right. I did have one other question, but I think I'll let it go. Is there anything else? We can close out the show now if you are so inclined.
I think we can call this one quits.
Very good. Make sure that you head over to registrymatters.co and find all of the show notes and everything. And for those of you new folks who have joined in recently, then we have supporters over at Patreon, patreon.com. That's patreon.com/registrymatters. And for as little as $1 a month, you can listen to us record the show live. And there are a handful of people in chat, and we can talk and banter. There's a Discord server if you want to come hang out And it's all a good time. And like I said, even as a little as a buck a month, you can show some love for the show. And it really helps to inspire and help keep us doing this thing that so many people do enjoy us doing. And by golly, Larry, everyone in chat is saying how smart you are with these really good points about the public defenders. That part I can tell you for sure. So without anything else to say, I think we can head on out of here. Anything else you want to say before we go?
Have a great week.
Thanks, man. Have a great night. Talk to you later. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.